What I've come to talk to you about today is faith groups and complementarity. So this is a small part of a bigger piece of work involving sort of reformulating or re-expressing quantum mechanics in terms of Malloy mechanicals. And this is a particular aspect of it that I particularly excited about. So what are we trying to do here? So I'm a computer scientist or a proof theorist speaking by training. And so in computer science, we studied this thing, AROV, type of functions, for, I don't know, 100 years or something. But until that's been a long project. But much more recently, there was linear logic, and I said we can decompose this thing into two more primitive components, and lots of interesting results come from this. So in quantum mechanics, we have all this complicated stuff. The question is, what can we put in the other side to make it more simple? And so I'm going to show you some very simple algebraic gadgets here, which can do quite a lot of this work. Okay, so what we've been doing, we, I think, should be Samson just spoke, Bob Cooker, and about a dozen other people in Oxford, you know, for instance, here somewhere. I've done sort of translated much of the axioms of quantum mechanics into language and other categories, and by gradually increasing the amount of structure you put in, I can do more and more quantum mechanics. So I want to see what quantum mechanics. But in this talk, I'm particularly interested in observables. Some work of Bob Kirke, Dirk Pavlovich, Jamie Vickery, Eric Paquette, some people. I'll show that observables correspond to these frighteningly named special dagger Frobenius algebras, also known as classical structures, also known as basis structures, and for today, also known as observable structures. I will save those out a bit later. But if you have one of these things, then you can define a phase group, which I also will tell you about later. But phase groups correspond to several mutually unbiased bases. If you have mutually unbiased bases, then you start talking about complementary observables. And once you have these things, then you can have some more scary sounding algebraic things over here, which I won't talk about, but I think Bob will say something in the next talk. And those guys give rise to automorphisms for these phase groups. Okay, so there's kind of happy circle going on. So what is a phase group? So this is not a definition, it's just a description, but just think of it as an abelian group of unitary maps on a state space, which leaves some observable things. And you all know what these look like this. Here is the block sphere, here is the plus and the minus, and here is the rotations around the z-axis. This is the prototype of a phase group. So, as I said, this is going to be carried out in an abstract framework rather than in Hilbert space quantum mechanics. So what do you need here? So the ingredients of this sort of tensor product, so we'll be working in a symmetric product category. We need unitarity. So that means that we're actually looking at dagger symmetric product category, because dagger quantum we use to define what it means to be unitary. And we need some observables, which are these special Lagrangian algebras or observable structures. So this is a very general collection of stuff. It doesn't just refer to quantum mechanics. There's lots of other models which look like this. And so part of my question is why bother looking at this? Probably because I want to know what you can learn about quantum mechanics by studying phase groups that actually happen in quantum theory, and what you can learn about quantum theory by looking at phase groups that happen in other theories which are kind of like quantum theory, and fit in and have those ingredients that I mentioned in the previous slide. So there's quantum theory, there's finite relations, there's toy models, complex operational theories, continuous variable quantum mechanics. Two particular toy models here, STAB and SPEC. I'm not going to talk about these in this talk, because I think Bill Edwards will give a talk on this later in the week. But in particular, these are two toy models. This one is a kind of a toy qubit-like thing based on stabilized formalism. This is Rob Speckin's epistemic model. You formalize these in category of relations, they're almost exactly the same, except they have different phase groups. Except this is like quantum mechanics, and this is a local hidden variable model. So maybe we can learn something here. So this is me running around the perimeter institute with my butterfly net, trying to capture all these weird theories, which are something like quantum mechanics, and find out what their phase groups are. So I figured this room must be like but the greatest concentration of people who are expert at things which are almost quantum mechanics. So please talk to me after the talk, because you're not going to address this kind of stuff. Okay, so. So, disclaimer. We've lost words in the first slide, and now we lost the definition to explain what those words mean. Hopefully, I will not bore you too much. Okay, so. Yeah, the first thing that's worth thinking about is, why is quantum mechanics different from other mechanics? And the reason is because of the incompatibility, the possibility for observables to be incompatible. And so the archetypal pair are the momentum and position. Right? So if you're an expert in quantum mechanics, you can use this incompatibility to escape from scalar monsters. But more prosaically, I think of an observable as just being a basis. I won't worry about degenerate observables, I'll just take some basis in my state space. And I think of every basis as describing an observable. So there, there, or here, and these things are what we call complementary when the angles between the basis vectors are equal, right? Or remote size in finite dimensions when this inner product is always this constant number. And if I have two bases with this property, then they're called mutually unbiased. And so, in my mind, mutually unbiased basis and complementary observables are the same thing. So, the prototype of these kind of things is X and Z spins with Geo, the electron, I should say. And so, you have some qubit, you can measure its Z spin, see one of these outcomes, you can measure its X spin, see one of these outcomes, or these are the probabilities. In particular, if you already know that you're in a Z eigenstate, then if you measure X, you're equally likely to see either, right? This is what it means to be complementary or to be mutually unbiased. But of course, since you're already in a Z eigenstate, if you measure Z, you probably want to see the thing you're already in. Okay? And vice versa, if you're already in an X eigenstate. Now, the connection that I want to sort of just emphasize here is if you already are in an eigenstate, then you know probability one if you measure that observable to see it again. And I want to contrast this with the no-cloning theorem, which says if I have a quantum state, then I can copy it, I can define a unitary operation which will copy two states, setting psi to psi tensor psi, phi tensor psi, phi tensor phi, if and only if these are orthogonal, or in the language I just said a minute ago, if and only if these are both eigenstates of some observable. And likewise for erasing operations, I can only map two things unitarily up to the same point if they're offline. And so as Samson mentioned in his talk, you can take this, I've not told you what is a Dagger compact canopy yet, but as Samson mentioned in his talk, if you have such a thing, you try to define these universal copying or universal erasing operations, the category collapses. So even in the abstract framework, which I'll explain in the next few slides, we won't be able to have, we'll have an equivalent to some important link here.
Is that, if you try to define either one?
Either
one. So, the reason I'm saying this is because I want to be interested in when I am going to copy and delete a quantum state. And so the way we're going to axiomatize observables in this framework is in terms of copying and erasing operations. Okay, so here's a sort of sketch of what I'll say in the next 35 minutes. So I'm going to basically describe to you monoidal categories. I'm going to describe to you what these observable structures are, which is some formulation of observables defined in terms of copying and deleting operations. Then I'll show you constructing the phase groups from these gadgets. And then I will describe what happens when you have two observables, which are complementary, and how this affects the structure of the phase groups. Okay? But before that, I will talk a little bit about monoidal categories. How many people know everything or know lots about the monoidal categories? Particularly, how many people know everything I'm going to say in the next 5 minutes? Okay, half people did. Almost all people. Okay, so when I look at categories, you can think of this as a very, very general framework for describing processes. So we have a category that is an object, which I call ABC, ABC, A, B, C, D, E, F, whatever. And I have arrows which go between them. So I'm going to denote the objects as lines, and we have the arrows and boxes on those lines. Think of these as operations. If I have two arrows which agree on the type of input that I'm expecting, but I can compose, the output of this agrees with the input of this, I can compose them. If I have three, I can compose them in a line like that. And this composition operation is associative, so if I bracket them that way, or bracket them that way, it doesn't matter. So my diagram, my pictorial notation, I won't draw any brackets, I'll just draw them like that. In particular, I have identity arrows which just correspond to this of line. If I take one of my operations and I put it next to some line, it doesn't matter which where on the line it is. So if you think of this as a matrix, I can multiply it with as many identity matrices as I want. Now, a monoidal category is a category with the tensor products, as well as sequential composition. You can also do parallel composition. So I keep my boxes side by side, and this defines a new composite object, A tensor C, or B tensor D. And the tensor is also associative, so again, I don't write brackets around my picture. So that was so far nothing, but the first victory for the diagram, the pictorial notation, is that in this case, I have this equation that says that if I put two things in sequence, I put two other things in sequence, I put them in parallel, that's the same thing as putting two things in parallel, putting their parallel, putting them in sequence. So that's an equation that I really do have to write in the textual case, but I don't have to write the pictorial case. And furthermore, for my composite objects A, so B, I have the identity arrow here, just as being two lines instead of one. Now, the special case of this picture is when G and H are identities, in the case it looks like this, and by the picture I just showed you, I can slide things up and down these lines, and again, it doesn't matter what order things on parallel lines occur. So, you also have composite operations taking several inputs to several outputs, like this. And you can have things which have no inputs. So, technically, what I want to say is the tensor product has a unit element. So, A, I tensor A is just A, and A tensor I is also just A. And the notation, I just won't write anything in this unit. So, I take a thing psi from I to A, I just draw a box, starts from over here, and has one. And so you can think of this as preparation of a fresh state. So next, I can think of something which is type A to I, so that's something that's going to consume a state. So you think of this as a ket, and you should think of this as a graph. I can pull these guys together, I play with log roots and log roots, and this is just a number. But this is the inner product of those two guys. Okay, so and these numbers, these scalars, are just disconnected components from these methods. And they enjoy these kind of commutation relations. So when I draw my picture, I can put them anywhere in the diagram I want. You know this already, because if you ever wrote down what a matrices, this tensor product from some of them, a sequential multiplication to some of them, you can pull out your scalar factors from wherever you want. Finally, this is a symmetric. Almost finally, this is a symmetric category. So we have a twist map, a particular symmetry map, and in particular two symmetry maps. And if I have two things for the crossing, I can push them both through the crossing and translate my stuff. Okay, so that's symmetric among categories. The next thing I want to add to this is dagger. So I want to talk about a bunch of things, I want to talk about unitary operations, so I need a way to introduce the entirety into the framework. So I have this dagger functor, and all it does is I have some operation from A to B, I have also f dagger from B to B. So I'm going to draw that by reflection. So here's F, and here's a joint at the same time, BFN. And then if I have that, then I can define what it means to be unitary. If I say if I compose F as I joint, or if I joint with F, then they should both be the identity. Okay, so for example, a category we know which has all these features is a category of five-dimensional Hilbert spaces. So your objects, your types, are just Hilbert spaces. The arrows are any linear maps. The tensor product is the usual tensor product. And the unit element of the tensor product is the underlying field of the complex numbers. F dagger is the usual adjoint. And in particular, notice that if I've got a map of this kind from the underlying field into a space, then it's, because this is only one dimensional here, it's entirely defined by its value of 1. So this is picking out one vector. So these are the points of this space, and these are the cool points. So these are the heads, these are the graphs. I compose them, I get the inner point. This is just beautiful. Okay. So I can start to draw pictures of this stuff now, right? So here's a picture. So the way I understand this is that this is no input and one output. So it's going to be of that type. And I'll choose them. And I'll just say that these are, in fact, state 0. So let's just do that. And I have the next part of my diagram, which is this. But this is in parallel with an identity, so it's denotation with this. And then finally, I'll take this one, which says C0 on it, and I'll understand it's a C0. So I'm showing that at the center of this ad hoc translation from this pictorial notation into matrices. Okay? Now, here's the first little glitch. If I take this matrix, I can now multiply, I mean, it won't be very small, but I can multiply it out and I can see what I've got. Whereas in this setting, I don't have any equations yet, so I can't really do anything. So I'm going to have to add some more structure. Before I do, I will just mention one other example just so you don't think it's all the Hilbert spaces. So here's the category of finite relations. So this is also diagram drawing, and the structure is as follows. The objects are sets, but the arrows are relations between sets. So a relation is just a subset of the Cartesian product. So an element here can be related to any number of elements here or not. So the tensor product in this setting is just the Cartesian product of sets, and the unit element is the one-point set. Okay, so the dagger is just the converse, so we switch around the places in the relation.
You don't mean F D hill, you mean F rel.
Oh, sorry, I forgot to change that there. Yeah, it's changed here. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Okay. So where before we had that our points were kets, here they're subsets. So you think of a relation, this is the unit element of the tensor, a relation in this form, is just everything can either be related to this point or not. And so this is just a subset of x. And the converse is also just a subset of x. And so if you take the inner product between two relations, then it's either empty, or if these sets are not empty intersections, then it's for whatever. But if you think, remember the reason the scalars are not just this one-point set, the relation is on this one-point set. So there's two of them. There's an empty and an empty relation. I'm going to skip over this because I'm not actually going to use this. So, compact closure means that you have arrows that look like this. And in the category of group spaces, these things are just Bell states. So, for example, like this. And if you have this structure, then it gives you a point transportation. And so, here would be my Bell state, and I can take it's adjoint here, so this is a projection rather than a measurement, so it's a post-like rotation. If I remove my annotation, I just have this curvy line. Straight. This corresponds to the error. And then if Alex wants to send some information to Bob exactly, then he just tells Bob what error he saw and Bob can correct.
So Ross,
compact closure means you have Bell states and Bell measurements? Is that right?
No, you just have Bell states and projectors onto that state.
Projectors onto
that state. You don't necessarily have those spectrum.
Right, okay, double right from the line up to outputs, which you do have those.
Yeah, you, because you've got, if you've got a state, you've always got its adjoint, so you've got a plan or so. So the reason that I kind of mentioned that is so I can state following theorem, but if I have all the stuff I mentioned in the previous few slides, then I can draw any old diagram I want using all this stuff, and as long as I don't break the topology, then it will always be equal to any deformation of itself. So it is equal by the acting of the carrier. Okay, that's the sort of syntax. First, I will more. So this is talking about observable structures. As I mentioned a bit earlier, I want to define observables in terms of bases, in terms of copying and bidding operations. So let's think of what operations, what properties a copying operation should have. Okay, so this is an input, two outputs, and this is no outputs. This is copy, delete. So if you copy something and copy, it shouldn't matter which copy, so it's associated. If you copy something and you erase a copy, haven't done anything, so it should have a unit on the other side too. And if you copy something, then two copies should get identical, so it should be symmetric. So altogether, this makes these two guys into a commutative comonoid. And because we have the dagger end, I can think about the duals or the adjoints of these guys, and those should be a commutative monoid. By flipping them up, I should flip those things instead of rotating. Okay. Furthermore, we've got a couple of extra things to make this into a special Frobenius algebra. First of all, we ask that the isometrics, if I copy something and then co-copy it, or fuse them back together, should be identity. And we have this slightly odd looking commutation of Frobenius law. Okay. So these are the equations, and this is an example of what they look like. If I take some Hilbert in the finite dimensional spaces again, if I take some space A, I can write down delta, taking A into its tensor product itself, by picking a basis, AI, and sending those guys onto the diagonal. And I can erase those ones by just taking the equal sum of those spaces elements and mapping them onto one. So, for example, in the case of qubits, I can set 0 to 0, 0, I can set 1 to 1, 1. And this, the erasing point you can see, is just the adjoint of the plus state. So, clearly, this copies the standard basis, but by plugging some other state to it, say plus, it doesn't get copied, it gets turned into an entangled state. And that gives us a clue that if we have one of these things, then we can find the problem. So this is the key theorem which connects this stuff to observables. It says that since you do occupied probability of Vickery, so that in F.D. Hilb, every observable structure, or the observable structures are in bijective correspondence to the basis. And just they just correspond to the obvious way. The one that copies the basis corresponds. So each well-behaved observable, i.e. orthonormal, not degenerate, so I find the basis, and so each observable corresponds to an observable structure. And I will skip over this bit. Just to say that if we have these things, we have compact structure. But the more interesting statement is the following. If I have some map which is made out of those guys, some diagram made by proposing those, something like this, then it turns out that it's uniquely determined just by the number of inputs and the number of outputs. So I can just replace it with three dot plots of things. It's called spider field. Okay. Now I want to start talking. Now I've shown you what the observable structures look like. I can really get into the meat of what I want to talk about today, the space maps. So I have an observable structure, I can define a monoid on my points, right? So Arik said that the delta dagger is a monoid. So I can pick some points, psi and phi, of this, psi and phi, and I can plug them into the arms of that multiplication and define a new dagger. And because I had all those equations earlier on, I have all these equations now. It's just the same thing stuck in. Which means that this operation, circle dot that I defined, is associative, it's commutative, and it has a unit element, namely the joule of the erasing map, but it's a variable structure. Yeah? So this is this operation itself, commutative monoid. So I will show an example of this part. Yes, everyone is here confused or asleep. Okay, so here's delta z on a qubit. Right? So I'm going to take my standard basis I, and I'm going to say I test I. I'll take, and this is its matrix, right? It's the matrix of delta dagger. And if I take two random states, phi and psi, and then I can feed them into this guy to get the circle product. Here's the tensor product, which is a vector, and when I multiply these guys, you can see that I'm just going to pick out that element and that element. So you multiply them together, circle dot psi of phi is just the pointwise product of the vectors in this case.
What kind of geometric meaning has that?
Geometric meaning? I'm not sure.
Maybe if you show me vectors, I point with my fingers. Vectors in a two-dimensional space, I should have some geometric picture.
I'll show you a geometric picture shortly. Okay. So that was a circle dot thing implied by putting in two points into this delta thing operation. But I can also just put in one, right? So I just put in one. But I'm sort of one input to one input back. So this should be an endomorphism of my state space. So I'm going to do it like this. And because this thing is commutative and etc., then I have now a homomorphism of monoids taking that circle dot thing onto composition of arrows. So I can define the image of all the points under this thing, giving me a commutative monoid among the endomorphisms of the state space. Okay. And in particular, it also commutes with the green dot. Just because if you unpack its definition, then you have all these equations. Okay. So I'll just show a quick example of that one. So the same thing again, except with one point. Then we can sort of put the identity matrix to get this thing. And then we just want to put it into here and get out the diagonal. Okay. Okay, so that is how you construct a monoid. And if you have all that stuff, then we can define this generalized spider theorem. So now I take all of my deltas and epsilons that I had before, and I sprinkle in some points into the mixture. And because I can define the circle dot product, then I can again just collapse everything down to a spider, annotate the product of all those points. Okay, so the question then is, when is this thing unitive? This is why I showed you matrices earlier, so you would have a clue at this point. Okay, so the answer is it's unitary if and only if this vector psi is unbiased with respect to the basis copied by delta. Okay, so if you think of it this thing being unitary means if I compose it with its adjoint, this is the adjoint, I should get the identity. And so if I define this one to be green alpha, then this one should be its inverse, but I call it a minus alpha. So here's the proposition. If I take the unbiased one with respect to some observable structure, and I get an abelian group with respect to this operation, and furthermore, the lifting of those points onto the state space gives you an abelian group with respect to composition of matrices. So here's the example. Here's my copied points in the qubit. Probably 0.05 for some reason. And here are the unbiased points, all in green. And you know, to be unbiased, it means the inner product with the plus state, which is here, and the minus state should be equal, or at least equal magnitude. So these two components must be equal magnitudes each term A is here. So the group that you get from constructing the space group for a qubit is just a circle around the equator of the box here. Okay, so I'll denote each point there by alpha, just to indicate it's the one around the group. And so the construction I showed earlier seems that you took the matrix of this, a matrix of the form 0 plus EPI alpha, and you get this diagonal map with EPI alpha in here, so it's just your usual Z rotations. Is that geometric enough, Andreas? Not really.
Let's think about it.
Essentially, if you think about what that, what this guy does is he kills the orthogonal elements that you put into him, right, from your product. And so you're just compressing your pair of matrices onto the diagonal.
You want a geometric interpretation of circles, is that what you're asking for?
Actually, my question was more about the situation where you had two vectors, and then you had this strange product where the components were multiplied.
Right. This is a well-known thing in group theory called the Schur product.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it has geometric significance, but it has
And if you restrict to the case where everything is unbiased, because I mean, it's possible in general for these things to be zero, right? If you restrict to the unbiased situation, then what it means is, when you're sitting on this equator, then if I say I've got sine phi, one of them defines a point here and the other one just rotates it around the circle. That's what you do geometrically. Okay. Or we can think about two trits. In that case, here's a copy map turning each of these guys again to the diagonal. And in this case, the unbiased points take this form, 0 plus some phase is 2. And in this case, the collection of the unbiased, the phase group product looks like this. So diagonal elements again, and phase and phase. Of course, they're always diagonal. This is, well, we already knew that they were abelian, right? So this is, I mean, showing them on a slide. When you write them down in the basis of that delta thing, they're always diagonal. And so this then corresponds to some kind of the torus rather than to a circle. And you can see, sort of, by the way this construction goes, it might think an n-level system, I'll get an n minus 1 dimensional torus in the phase group. Okay. Or maybe not in Hilbert spaces, we can think about EFRA. So here's a cool copying operation. I just take elements which are on diagonal and relate them to this. And the ones which are not on the diagonal don't relate. So I take some point in here, and compose it, then you can see that this is only going to be unitary if this point psi is relating the entire x. And in that case, this will just turn out to be the identity. Is that clear? So in the case of this, it's kind of very obvious construction of relations to give you a copy map, then you get only trivial phase group. So let me just talk about now what happens when you have two of these things. So these are my points. And so I can also talk about what happens to the actual guys who are copied by this, right? We're calling them classical points. And so they have the equations like this, they're copied. And as I said before, I have my unbiased points, which satisfy this weird equation corresponding to lambda of alpha being here. In particular, there's always at least one, right? Because this guy is an example. Okay. And if I have two bases, I can define two classical structures. And I'll say they're complementary when the following things are true. First of all, everything which is a basis, a classical point for one of them, should be unbiased for the other, and vice versa. And thirdly, that I would like this erasing point to be a classical point for the other color.
So I've got at least one possible point for each column. So I get the qubits, the snips, and the blocks here like this. So here's my group of unbiased points, and here's my possible points, the poles. And I can start the other one with the different equator passing through those poles and perpendicular to the classical points here. Okay, so in this case, your classical points are the plus and minus state, and your rotations are the x rotations instead of z rotations. And in Q trips, it looks kind of like this. Again, this is what I showed you last time. This is the unbiased basis, and this is the corresponding phase group. But you can see again, it's just a two-parameter thing. This is the Fourier transform for that. So part of my original definition was saying that the eigenstates of some observables should be preserved by the phase group. So I'll just show you this very short proof. So here's my phase element, here's my eigenstate. So this by definition is equal to that by the Spinor theorem. And now this is classical for this thing, so you can be copied. And so what I have now here is the same point that I started with, times some scalar factor, the eigenvalue. Okay. Now I'm particularly interested in the case where we have this further property, where they're called closed whenever we have this. I have two classical points for this green structure, then their product, according to the red multiplication, should also be copied by green. Okay. And vice versa. So in Hilbert, you can always construct these guys. In particular, if you take the first one to be the standard basis, and you take any scale n, and you take any length n cycle, its eigenvalues will always give you a complementary basis, which will have this problem. But if you're above dimension 4, or you're 4 or 6 and above, you can construct some kind of examples which don't have this problem. But for our practical purposes, we can assume this is true. So by the definition of complementarity, you have that all the ones which are classical for the X structure are inside the unitary, the unbiased group for the Z, and vice versa. So if you have this closure property and you have only finitely many classical points, then you have a subgroup of these form of subgroups with respect to the X multiplication, even though these are the Z classical points. And in particular, if you lift them up to the endomaps, then these guys are permutation themselves. Okay, so here's the entire mess again, but I specialize these guys in the case where alpha is pi, because the first one is 0, the other one is pi, and you can see that what I get here are the Pauli matrices, and so these obviously form two element groups. Okay, so this closure property is quite strong. It applies a lot of stuff, which I'll just mention now. So if I have this, then I also know that the maps which these classical points induce are homomorphisms for this thing, so they commute like that. I know that if I have a green classical map and I have a red classical map, then they also commute, but picking up a scalar factor. So in particular, if you think of Pauli X and Pauli Z, then this factor is minus 1. Yep, there they go. And they also form the phi algebra. So I think Bob will copy that. And so the last kind of structural thing that I want to mention in this thing is that if you take some element of your unbiased group and you act on it with one of these classical points, then you still get an unbiased point. So we can just check that by forming its unitary map, or forming what we hope is unitary map, and composing it with this algebra. And by that homomorphism property, this can commute. This one also. By unitarity, they cancel. We already knew by hypothesis that this was unitary, so that can all cancel. And again, this is unitary, so it cancels. So those classical maps preserve the entry group, the unbiased group. So. And in fact, it's not just they preserve it, but actually they are automorphisms of the group. So this just some equations to show that the group structure is also preserved by these kind of maps. So in some ways, the classical points, the eigenstates of some observable are symmetries of the phase group for that observable. So I'll just finish off an example again of Q-trits. So here is my unbiased, my phase group for the first observable. Here's my phase group for the second observable. So I know that these points are, we get the classical points when alpha is either 0 pi by 3 or 2 pi by 3, and beta should be 2 pi minus alpha. It's just an easy calculation. Okay, so in that case, the classical points correspond to these matrices. You can see this is just a 3-element cyclic group. In particular, if you look at the z one, you can see it's just shifting vectors along. So the point is, not so obviously these signs are a subgroup of the diagonal ones, but also these ones are going to give me an automorphism of that diagonal group. So I'll just pick this guy as an example. So here's my matrix. Here's my point, which is unbiased for. So this is defined by an eigenstate for z. This is a point which is unbiased for z. I act on them. I get this, and then I just rephase it to this. And you can see that in terms of a torus, I have my two parameters and I transform them like that. That corresponds to some kind of symmetry of this torus that I've not imagined enough to take what it looks like. Okay. So what I showed was that if you have an observable for extremely general reasons, or you have two observables, sorry, if you have one observable, for extremely general reasons, you have these two groups. The group defined by its eigenstates, and the group defined by phases relative to this observable. And furthermore, if you have two observables which are complementary in the sense I defined, then you have the action of the eigenstates on the unbiased group as an automorphism group. Okay. There are lots of things that can go on from here in terms of talking about multi-part entanglement, talking about measurement-based quantum computing. I mentioned talking at the beginning of the talk, whether one can use these ideas to construct mutually unbiased bases in general. And I also have some other ongoing work which I just mentioned, using these kind of picture calculator and automated tool, which you can download from this address. And I think I mentioned results by only these people, but I'm sorry if I missed that. This is the paper describing all of this. And it should be on the archive a bit later in the week. Thank you.